Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Today we are having a conversation about one of the greatest business people I've ever heard of in my entire life, and that person is Walt Disney. Many of us are familiar with Disney, whether it's Disney World, Disneyland, all the movies and the other bits and pieces that Disney is so well known for. But very few of us understand the wisdom of Walt. Walt and his brother Roy built the empire that we now know today as the Disney Corporation. But what are the lessons that came out of that? What are the setbacks? What are the failures? What are the things that worked really well? And how do we incorporate some of those lessons into our own business today? So my guest is Jeff Barnes, and Jeff is an expert on all things Walt Disney. He has studied Walt from a very young age. He's dedicated his entire life to understanding the Disney company, the Disney family, and all that goes on in Disney organization. And he is perhaps one of the leading experts on the planet when it comes to understanding Walt particularly. And so in our conversation with Jeff, we're going to talk all about the qualities that make up Walt. What kind of person was he? What allowed him to achieve such phenomenal success? And what were his early setbacks? And how did they shape him? What were the consequences of those setbacks? And how did it really create the Disney that we know today? So you're going to hear stories of leadership, you're going to hear stories of courage, you're going to hear stories of success, and you're also going to hear stories of failure. We're also going to learn about the important relationship that Walt had with his older brother Roy and how they formed such a powerful partnership to develop the Disney brand that it is today. Now, on Jeff's website, which is called The Wisdom of Walt, there's a wonderful blog there. I'm going to encourage you to head across to that blog, subscribe to that. It's totally free, and just get your head into this lesson, because I really think that there's some things here that'll help you accelerate the progress of your own practice. Now, speaking of accelerating the progress of your own practice, if you are a motivated and driven practice owner and you want to go faster in your practice, you want to have a greater income, you want to see your vision fulfilled, you want to really build a practice that you're proud of, then I'm going to encourage you to come and join us in the Savvy Dentist Facebook group, because in that group, we have tools and trainings and we have some resources there that will help you on your journey. It is a group primarily for practice owners, and we are talking about the business of dentistry. And if that's something that interests you and fascinates you and you want to get better at, then come and join us. So all you need to do though is head across to Facebook, search Savvy Dentist in the search bar, answer a few questions on entry, and we'd love to welcome you into the group. But for now, let's have a conversation with Jeff Barnes. I know you're going to love this. Have a pen and paper handy, because there's plenty of lessons here for you. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to come and join us on the Savvy Dentist Podcast, all the way from Southern California. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Absolutely thrilled to be here.
Jeff, you are world-renowned as an aficionado of Walt Disney. You've studied his life. You've been fascinated by Walt Disney and all that he's created for many, many years. In fact, you've built a career around it. I'm curious to ask, because that's not something you normally have on your career form as a kid. I want to study Walt Disney and I want to kind of teach others about the wisdom of Walt. How and when did your fascination with all things Disney related begin?
Here in the United States, going to a Disney park is kind of a rite of passage. It's sort of expected that every, parent is going to take their kids to either Disneyland or Walt Disney World. And so, my parents took me when I was 10 years old to Walt Disney World. We were living in the panhandle of Florida. Mm-hmm. We went and I loved it. It's like, whoa, this is amazing. If there really is a heaven, at least here on Earth, we found it.
Yep.
And I became that kid from 10 up until I graduated high school. If for whatever reason we were going to Walt Disney World, I was the most looking forward to it. I was counting down the days. I mean, it was just absolutely insufferable. Well, fast forward, I moved to California to go to graduate school. I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is 8 hours north of Los Angeles. And I make it down to Southern California and go to Disneyland, which was Walt's original park back in 1988. And I'm really looking forward to this trip.
Yeah.
And I hated it.
Oh, wow.
It's way too small. It's underwhelming. I walk in on a Sunday in August. It's too hot. It took more than 3 hours to experience the first attraction. And by the end of the day, I was just done. And if you had told me then that I'd be doing what I am doing now, aka Dr. Disneyland, I would have said you're absolutely nuts. But the interesting part was I stayed in California. And by doing so, I learned that way more than Florida, the locals in California freaking love this place. I mean, they're just obsessed with it. I was like, okay, you like the one in Florida as a kid, but not like the people in California. Like these people are a different level.
Yeah.
What did I miss? And so I got super curious. Like I literally fell down the rabbit hole like Alice in Wonderland. And that's when I discovered Walt was not born successful, difficult childhood, difficult relationship with his father, more failures than successes. And even at age 53, despite Mickey Mouse, despite Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, despite the successes that he did have underneath him, when it came time to build a magic kingdom out of an orange grove in Anaheim, California, he had to overcome every obstacle imaginable. And I fell in love with the story. And when I found out that he built the park for that purpose, to tell stories that are actually inspiring us to then go out and live our own great story, I went back. I couldn't get enough of it. And I've always been a person who loved story anyway. And I wanted to tell stories that could help people. And that marriage just, you know, became something that, like you said, just sort of became my life story and my life career. I'm like, you know, here's this person who, like all of us, wasn't born successful, overcame all of these obstacles, built this amazing place. How can I leverage it so that people don't just go there for an escape, but can see it as an example?
I really love that, because I think, you know, throughout life, we have those periods of time where, you know, there's a little switchiness that flicks, and we can take that as just an experience, or we can take it as a lesson to move forward with life. What kind of man was Walt Disney?
He was relentless. We hear the word resilient today.
Yeah.
And that was Walt. And people don't realize that. He was born in Chicago, Illinois, 1901. He adored his mother. Father never understood him. He very much had an artist spirit.
Yes.
And at age 17, he wanted to run off and join the army and fight in World War I, but he wasn't old enough. And so he finally convinced his mother to help him forge his birth certificate so he could at least be in the Red Cross Ambulance Corps.
Yep.
He was delayed in being shipped off because he caught the Spanish flu. You know, we all just went through COVID, right?
Yeah.
Walt nearly died from the last global pandemic, which was, you know, the Spanish flu in you know, 1918, 1919. Gets back from that and has no clue what he wants to do with his life. You know, ambulance driver, actor, artist, animator, moves to Kansas City and starts his first studio. And interestingly enough, works with a local dentist in Kansas City, creating animation advertisements, hoping to teach children to brush their teeth.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. There we go.
Yeah. Now, he works on a couple of other projects, but that's one of his main projects. And that studio lasts all of 18 months.
What happened?
Exactly 100 years ago, 1923, Laugh-O-Gram Studio and Walt Disney go bankrupt.
Wow.
And it's the bankruptcy that compels Walt to come to California. Now, he could have just given up. He could have just stayed in Kansas City. But rather than doing that, he boards a train to come to California. But he boards that train with $40, a single suitcase, and a one-way ticket. And that's my version, or the way I tell that story when I give a keynote, is if you want to accomplish something, you've got to board the train. And when you board that train, you go all in.
Yeah.
Walt knew he was going to be successful. He knew he wasn't coming back. He was all in, $40 single suitcase, one-way ticket.
That's like the burn the boats metaphor, isn't it? You know, you land on the beach and you got to burn the boats because it's either victory or death, basically, in that metaphor. Exactly. But so Walt's, he's obviously, as you say, he's relentless, he's focused, he's determined, he's committed to this success. Where did that self-confidence and self-belief come from if he didn't have such a great upbringing with his dad? Was it his mom that was the nurturer in that relationship there?
His mom encouraged Walt, but there was another very powerful force in his life, and that was his 8-year older brother, Roy.
Yeah.
Roy was in Los Angeles and had written to Walt and said, you've given the studio the best that you can. I think it's time that you let it go and come on out to California. And he comes out to California to join forces with Roy. And Roy is in a VA hospital recovering from tuberculosis.
Okay.
And together in 1923, they found the Disney Brothers Studio that today is the largest entertainment company anywhere in the world.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And so Disney this year is celebrating its 100th anniversary, which I think is fantastic. But that celebration is on a foundation of failure and bankruptcy.
Let's talk a bit about, you know, the establishment of Disney Studios. What were those early days in the studio look like? Because we see what is probably the finished product. We see a global media company. Obviously, they've bought the rights to many different things in recent times, whether it's Star Wars or the Muppets or whatever else, you know, the Marvel. I think they own Marvel as well now.
Correct.
You know, we know about Bob Eisner and all those sorts of later people. But the early days, what was that like? I mean, with Roy and Walt, you know, the Disney Brothers Studio, what were they doing in those early days? And what are the lessons that come out of that, of course? Because, I mean, it's an interesting story. But as you say, it's the lessons that come out of this that we can apply to our own lives.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, believe in yourself. Go all in, $40 single suitcase, one-way ticket.
Yeah.
Don't give up. But then secondly, you accomplish things together.
Mm.
And so it's the Disney Brothers Studio, right?
Yep.
And I tell people all the time, the difference between Laffer Graham Studio, which lasted all of 18 months and went bankrupt, and the Disney Brothers Studio that today is celebrating its 100th anniversary and is the largest entertainment company anywhere in the world. The difference between the two is not Walt.
It's Roy.
The difference is Roy.
Yeah.
If Walt had ran the second studio without Roy, he would have driven it off the financial cliff all over again.
Hmm.
So you've got to get the right people on the right bus going in the right direction.
Hmm.
Now, Roy would have spent the rest of his life selling vacuum cleaners door to door.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it took the two of them together to make Disney what it would become. And for the first 4 years, they worked on a series called the Alice Comedies, where Walt was taking a little girl and putting her into animation. Which was sort of unheard of at the time. So if you remember Mary Poppins, where Dick Van Dyke dances with the penguins, or Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where, again, you have live action mixed with animation. Walt was trying to accomplish that in, you know, the early 1920s, which, again, was like unheard of. And the challenge was he was virtually making no money at it, but he wasn't going bankrupt either. And, you know, he and Roy managed to build kit homes side by side next to each other in the Los Feliz neighborhood in Los Angeles. And then he finally creates his first successful cartoon character. And that character would be who?
Mickey.
No.
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 Oswald the Lucky Rabbit.
Really? I always thought it was Mickey and the Steamboat, but no, okay.
99% of the world thinks it is Mickey because Walt tells us, never forget, it all started with a mouse.
Yeah.
It did not. It started really with a little girl named Alice, and then it started with Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And a year later, he goes to New York City. Now, he's married. He's married to Lily, and he heads to New York City. He wants to sit down with his distributor, Universal, and a fellow by the name of Charles Mintz, because again, he's not making enough money. And Oswald is wildly successful, and he wants to renegotiate the contract. And in the meeting, he is reminded that when he signed the distribution deal, he signed away the rights to the character. And while he's been away in New York City, Universal has been busy in Southern California hiring away the very animators that helped make Oswald so successful. He does not walk out of that meeting with a bigger and better contract. He walks out with nothing.
Wow. And then gets back to California where he's lost his animators, presumably.
Well, yeah, the animators are gone before he ever leaves New York City.
Wow. So he literally came back worse off than he left.
Yeah. A couple of things happen here. First of all, before he ever gets on the train ride home, sends a telegram to his brother Roy. This is March 13th, 1928, and says, leaving tonight, we'll be home Sunday, 7:30 a.m., stopping over in Kansas City. Don't worry, everything okay. Now, on March 13th of 1928, Walt Disney had everything in the world to worry about.
Yeah.
Because he is staring bankruptcy in the face all over again for the second time in 5 years. And this time he's going to take his brother down with him.
Yeah.
But on that train ride home, he remembers a little mouse that kept him company when the studio was failing in Kansas City. Got a pad of paper, sketches out a story, shows it to his wife, Lily, and says, honey, what do you think of this guy? And she says, wow, Walt, he's cute. What are you going to name him? And he says, I'm not sure. What do you think of Mortimer? Now, I don't know what the heck a Mortimer is. And it's not like Oswald was a great name anyway. Fortunately, Lily says, oh, God, no, Walt. That name is terrible. Go with Mickey instead.
Love it. So this is on the train ride back west to California.
Correct.
He gets back. He's basically gone to this meeting in New York. He's come away not only empty-handed without a better deal, but he's gone back and his animators are no longer there. They're long gone. So is it back to square one with he and Roy again? Is it kind of back to, okay, it's just the two of us and now we've got this mouse. What do we do from here? That's basically the story, right?
Right. But then there's another piece to the story. And that is the very first Mickey Mouse cartoon is not actually Steamboat Willie. It's Plain Crazy. Because again, this is 1928. And the aviator who had flown from New York to Paris, Charles Lindbergh, was like the most popular anyone on the planet. And so Walt has a Mickey cartoon that sort of celebrates that event.
Yes.
And he can't find a distributor for Plain Crazy. And so he's like super, super frustrated with that. And then he realizes, oh, there's this great technology called synchronized sound. So he sells his car so that he can invest in the technology of synchronized sound and produces another cartoon, which is Steamboat Willie. And Plain Crazy is produced in May. But Steamboat Willie comes out in November.
Wow. Okay.
And everybody knows Steamboat Willie, A, because of synchronized sound, but then B, because it is actually released in the theaters because it gets a distributor.
So, Jeff, we obviously know that Mickey and Steamboat Willie was a big success. Obviously, we know that that led to good things. But on that way home on that train ride, or before he got on the train, he sent the telegram, everything okay, don't worry. What sort of character was Roy, and would he have taken solace in that telegram? Was he a warrior by nature? Was he a planner? You said a moment ago Disney Brothers Studios would not be what it is today without Roy, and we've all kind of focused so much on Walt, but we also know that Roy is a very integral part of the story. So I'm curious to ask what his particular attributes were like and how he might have received that telegram. And obviously it all went well because we know how the story ends, but what kind of person was he?
Walt was incredibly optimistic. And yet at the same time, he could have, pretty dark mood swings.
Right.
And I think, that's pretty stereotypical of an artist's personality, whereas Roy was more grounded, more stable, more, predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Roy gets the telegram. He picks them up at the train station on Sunday morning. You know, he's happy to hear that, you know, he's come up with a new character, but okay, so what is like what does that mean? Like, where are we going to go? What are we going to do with it?
Yeah.
You know, and the good news is their most talented animator, a fellow by the name of Ub Iwerks, never left the fold.
Right. Okay.
You know, and that was probably Walt's greatest. Walt had two great strengths. He was Hollywood's best storyteller.
Yes.
But he was also a phenomenal human resources director. And what I mean by that is he put together an incredible team of talent. He wasn't the best animator. He wasn't the best Imagineer. Like, Walt wasn't the best at anything. But he had a vision for what he wanted, and was always willing to hire better than himself, and that never threatened him.
I think there's a really good lesson there for business, isn't there? Because you don't necessarily have to be the best at everything, but you need to be able to surround yourself with the best people.
Absolutely.
And perhaps not let your ego get in the way. And
right.
If Walt's ego had been such that he needed to be the star of the show the whole time, then perhaps Disney wouldn't be what it is today, because it would only have been able to grow as much as Walt could manage, and that's, everyone's got their own, you know, limitations around that. So I'm curious to ask a little bit about the leadership style of Walt. You spoke about him being a great human resources person. What are the leadership lessons there? And it's really interesting. I'm thinking about the movie Saving Mr. Banks, which is obviously about the making of Mary Poppins. And here in Australia, you probably know that P.L. Travers, we have a deep affection for P.L. Travers, because she was from a town called Maryborough. And if you go to Maryborough in Queensland, the state north of New South Wales, you'll see all these lovely statues of Mary Poppins around the streets and so on. So we got a bit of an insight into what I suppose a fictional version of that event might have been. We've got to see a little bit about Walt and his leadership style, and I don't know if that was fact or fictional or dramatized for the sake of the movie, but what kind of character was he when he was dealing with his team?
So I've had the honor and privilege of interviewing Disney Imagineers, Disney legends who were hired by Walt, worked with Walt. And what I remember most, and I just wrote about this in my weekly blog a couple of weeks ago, what has always struck me about that is, you know, Walt's been gone, gosh, 55, 56 years now.
Hmm.
When I asked them, what was it like for you the day that Walt died?
Mm-hmm.
And Walt died December 15th, 1966. What was it like for you the day that Walt died? To a person, they tear up and they refuse to answer the question. They can't go there.
Oh, wow.
These are like beyond grown men, 70, 80, 90 years old.
Hmm.
And that man had such an impact, and they are so emotionally moved by his death, 55, 56 years after the fact, that they still will not talk about it.
Wow. That's a special person. Yeah, that is an incredible human being who's obviously had a dramatic impact. We all know about the impact of Disney, but the impact on those lives personally. Yeah.
And yet at the same time, they will say, when they walked into the meeting the first time they were introduced to him, they couldn't figure out who he was. He was just an ordinary guy.
So how do you explain that dichotomy of being an ordinary guy and an extraordinary leader? What's that dichotomy? What's happening there?
They were moved by how Walt never saw himself as much more than a farm boy from the Midwest.
So there's some humility about Walt?
He carried himself that way. He treated himself that way. He treated others that way. And yet at the same time, what really moved his cast members, his team members, was his ability to bring out of them gifts, talents, and abilities they themselves never knew that they had.
Do you have any insights as to how he did that?
Yeah. So Bob Gurr was hired when Disneyland was being created to originally design some of the Main Street vehicles, the Autopia vehicles in Tomorrowland, and would go on to, you know, build the submarine voyage, the, you know, monorail. Walt tapped him to do the Matterhorn, which was the first tubular steel roller coaster, Disneyland's first e-ticket thrill ride. And, you know, Bob Gurr hated roller coasters, wanted nothing to do with roller coasters, had no idea, you know, how to design one, how to build one. Like I said, I mean, he'd done Main Street vehicles, the Autopia vehicles, the submarine voyage, you know, I mean, he had no problem engineering, designing stuff. And when Walt said, "Hey, Bobby, I need you on this Matterhorn roller coaster," and Bob Gurr looks at him and says, "Walt, I don't know anything about roller coasters. I hate the darn things." And Walt just looks at him and says, "Well, Bobby, time you learn." And John Hinch was his favorite Imagineer. And he puts him on designing the Plaza Inn restaurant at the right end of Main Street for the 10th anniversary of Disneyland in 1965. And, you know, I mean, John Hinch is like the designer of Sleeping Beauty Castle.
Yeah.
And John Hinch is like, "A restaurant? I can give you another. I don't know anything about restaurants." And Walt's response was, "That's okay, John. Time you learn." And, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean with, you know, "Yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's life for me." And he taps Existencio to write the lyrics. And he was like, "I've never written a song in my life." What do you think the response was?
Time to learn.
Time you learn. Exactly. And they figured out, like, if Walt thinks I can do it, chances are I can probably do it.
Yeah. That faith. That faith is, I guess, you know, people may not have had faith in themselves, but the faith that Walt had in them to do that was contagious. And I guess it's that whole expression of, you know, people will live up to your expectations, or yep, in the worst case scenario, live down to your expectations as well. And exactly. So I guess the leadership lesson there is to have expectations and faith in your people, give them the environment to succeed, give them permission to try some stuff and maybe fail it a few times, because we know Walt had his share of failures, but to come good in the end and to be committed to that process.
So you walk into the park, every single cast member has a name badge, but only their first name.
Mm.
And the reason for that was Walt only ever wanted to be called Walt. He never wanted to be called Mr. Disney. And there's this great story of he's eating breakfast at the Carnation Inn restaurant on Main Street. And there's a new cast member that's serving him, and she's super nervous. It's Walt Disney. She's never met him before. And she's calling him Mr. Disney this, Mr. Disney that, because she doesn't know that he hates that. And finally, he looks up at her and says, "You know, young lady, there's only two misters here at Disneyland, Mr. Toad and Mr. Lincoln. You can call me Walt."
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah. So think of the difference between challenging his team to do things they didn't know they themselves can do versus "you can call me Walt."
He's obviously got a great sense of humility. He's got a great sense of self-confidence at the same time, though. So he's humble and confident at the same time. He's got a vision that he pursues relentlessly. He's obviously had his share of setbacks, because we know about the first bankruptcy, the almost bankruptcy when he went to New York. I wanted to ask you about courage with Walt, because it takes a fair amount of courage to go, "You know what, I'm going to go and build a theme park or two," as the case may be. How did that courage come about? Where did he draw on that strength? Where did that inner strength come from? And equally, how well placed was that courage? We know that obviously it went well with Disneyland and Disney World and so on and so forth, but it's easy to be courageous when you know it's going to work. But when you've got uncertainty and doubt and you've had some failures in the past, you know, all of us are human. Some of those doubts plague us. How did he work through those doubts, or was the vision just so compelling that he didn't care about the doubts? And was it courage, or was it just doggedness?
It was really doggedness. And I think that's what people don't realize. There were times when he was absolutely scared out of his mind.
Hmm.
So, for example, losing the studio in Kansas City, he never forgot. And he went back and paid all of his creditors. He never, ever forgot losing Oswald.
Hmm.
And, you know, people are really sort of uptight about how protective Disney is of their characters and their trademarks and their copyrights. Well, it's because Walt never got over losing Oswald, and nor should he have. And then in the middle of the Great Depression, with the success of Mickey Mouse, now he wants to do the world's first full-length animated feature film.
Yeah,
and nobody believed in it. Roy didn't want him to do it. The animators didn't want to do it. Lily didn't want him to do it. And he's like, no, like he never wanted to keep repeating himself. He always believed moving forward, expanding, not staying still, not staying stuck. And, you know, the banks didn't want to loan him the money. You know, this is going to be, you know, Walt's folly, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he's just like, no, we're going to do this thing. It's going to work out. You know, to this day, many believe that Snow White may be the most profitable movie Hollywood ever produced. And then when it came time for Disneyland, I mean, Roy and Lily believed, along with many others, that it would be bankrupt, shuttered, and forgotten in 6 months or less. And he goes out to the site. They built the entire park in exactly a year.
Holy moly, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they broke ground July of 1954. They opened it in July of 55. And he went out with one of the Imagineers. They were like 6 months into construction, and they'd spent half the money. And he says, we're halfway home. I've spent half the money. There's not a damn thing here worth showing to anyone. I'm scared.
Hmm.
I'm scared.
Hmm. So how did they pull it off?
Well, this is the other half of the equation. Walt could be a real SOB.
Yeah. Well, and by reputation, I mean, you don't build that kind of empire without having, you know, a bit of steel running through your spine as well, right? You've got to be able to call it as you see it. So I'm curious to understand and explore that SOB side of his nature as well. Is that what got Disneyland built in the end? Is that what, like, him just kind of cracking some heads and saying, let's get on with it?
Yeah, I mean, it was his willing. I mean, the original budget was $3.5 to $4 million. He spent 17.
Okay.
You know, he wasn't afraid to spend gobs of money on overtime to get it done. You know, he himself was there until, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, the last, I don't know how many months. And it was his personal pet. I mean, he knew where every blade of grass was.
Hmm.
If he wanted a tree here instead of there, he barked that it be put here instead of there.
Hmm.
You know, there's a famous story. And when I give tours, I love stopping here. There's a spot at the end of Main Street called Coke Corner.
Mm-hmm.
And Main Street is all about Walt's beloved childhood farming community in Marceline, Missouri, one of the few good memories that he had from his childhood. And they had a Coke Corner in Marceline, so we wanted to recreate that on Main Street at Disneyland. And it's an odd-shaped corner. So as a result, even though there are alternating red and white light bulbs, because it's an odd-shaped corner, there were two light bulbs next to each other that were the same color. Well, this drove Walt Disney nuts. And so one night he went to the maintenance yard and grabbed his own bucket of paint and his own paintbrush and painted the last light bulb half red and half white. I mean, that's how OCD he was.
Yeah.
And Disney to this day continues to paint that light bulb half red and half white.
I love that. So what I'm hearing is clarity of vision, doggedness to pursue it, nice HR, kind of good management, humility, confidence, all that sort of stuff, but also expectations of getting the job done, an attention to detail.
Absolute attention to detail.
And willing to invest to get it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So unshakable confidence there.
Yeah. The very first attraction finished for any Disney park anywhere in the world was the old Frontierland Stagecoach.
Mm-hmm.
And they were building it at the studio in Burbank, and then they shipped it 33 miles south to Anaheim. And the last piece on that attraction was the leather strap for the stagecoach. And it didn't matter what John Hinch did. He couldn't get that poor leather strap to Walt Disney's liking. And out of frustration, he threw it across the room and said, damn it, Walt, It's just a leather strap. Who's going to notice? Who's going to care? And Walt looked at him and said, John, you're underestimating people. The guests are going to notice. They are going to care. In fact, every time someone comes to Disneyland, they're going to see something. They're going to notice something that they've never seen or noticed before. That's what's going to keep them coming back again and again and again.
I wanted to ask you about Walt Disney World over in Florida, because that's a different kettle of fish.
Much larger kettle of fish.
Yeah. So again, he's got the California place going along. What was the thought process to say, hey, we've done this one, why not go again bigger and better? What was the thought or the impetus behind that?
So Walt hated sequels, never wanted to repeat himself, always wanted to be moving forward. And he said after the almost instant and overnight success of Disneyland, when cities around the country and countries around the world were calling and clamoring, hey, we love this, we want our own Disneyland.
Yeah.
His response was always the same. No, there will never be another Disneyland. No, 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 no. But then Walt started getting into urban planning. He wanted to fix the problems of the inner city, especially here in the United States. In addition, the data was telling him that despite the success of Disneyland, 5% of the guests in the park were from east of the Mississippi.
Right.
75% of the population at the time in the United States lived east of the Mississippi.
Yes.
So around 1959, he starts wondering, what if I built an East Coast Disneyland and combined it with my interest in urban planning and built a city of tomorrow?
Is this where Celebration comes in?
No, this is where Epcot comes in.
Ah, okay.
Because Epcot stands for Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow.
Huh, didn't know that.
Because Epcot wasn't supposed to be a theme park. It was supposed to be a domed city where people were going to live, work, and play together. The main reason they were doing Magic Kingdom or Disneyland 2.0 was to generate the revenue necessary to build the Epcot.
Got it.
So he looks in St. Louis, Niagara Falls, New York City, Palm Beach. He looks in a lot of different East Coast locations. And on the afternoon of November 22nd, 1963, flies over the property that would one day become Walt Disney World, and then stops in New Orleans flying back to California and hears that President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas that afternoon. When he hears that news, he realizes that the problems in the urban city need to be fixed sooner rather than later, and immediately commits to Orlando and starts buying up the land south almost immediately. And to put the size into comparison, Disneyland started at 160 acres. He would end up buying 27,440 acres in Florida.
Wow. Okay. Massive. Huge.
Yeah, huge. 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 And they would announce, he would get all but 300 acres before the Orlando Sentinel figured out that it was Disney buying all of it. If they figured out it was Disney, the prices would skyrocket.
So I'm just curious about that little town Celebration. Where does that fit into the picture?
So what happened was they buy the land. The Orlando Sentinel figures it out. They make the announcement in November of 65 that it's Disney that's coming. They're going to do a Disneyland 2.0, which is Magic Kingdom. Then they're going to do Epcot. Walt does a film announcing what all this is going to be about. And the focus is Epcot, 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 Epcot. And then 5 weeks later, he dies. They break ground in Florida 6 months after Walt dies. And there was a point where it was possible that they weren't going to do Florida at all. They could have just turned around, sold the land back, and been done with it. But Roy comes out of retirement and says, no, I'm going to spend the last years of my life seeing my brother's final wish and dream to fruition. And oh, by the way, it's not going to be called Disney World. It's going to be called Walt Disney World in honor of my younger brother.
Wow.
So they break ground in May of 67, and they open phase one, which is Magic Kingdom, the Contemporary Resort, the Polynesian Resort, and the monorail. They open that in October of 71. And then Roy dies in December of that same year.
Right.
And then nobody has a clue what to do with Epcot.
Yeah.
Because it's this dome city, and they're like what did Walt, like what the heck is it? And it's interesting because this is all over the news in the United States right now because of the governor in Florida.
Yeah. Yes. That's yeah. He's picked a fight, hasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually, there was pressure because Disney was given so much authority. There was pressure to build Epcot, and Disney did it, but they did it based on what they did know how to do, which was another theme park, but not the city that Walt had promised.
Right.
And Epcot is great, but it's a very different kind of theme park. It's not the city.
Yeah.
Eventually, they used some of the land that they had to do a Disney-type city called Celebration, and it got really sort of confusing and complicated, and they de-annexed it out of the Disney property. And the main reason they did that is, which is interesting in light of the current political battle, once you have people living on that property as property owners, they have a right to vote, and Disney didn't want that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Celebration is kind of what Walt wanted, but if you go back, so you can go on YouTube and put in, you know, like Walt's Epcot film.
Yeah.
And he says in there, everything I'm telling you is going to change. And people forget that. But they were never going to have permanent citizens in Epcot because there was no way for you to be a permanent citizen of Epcot without the ability to vote in the United States.
Yeah. Okay. Well, having been to Celebration, I really like it. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. I could live there in a heartbeat, with the exception of my friend's backyard having an alligator in it. That I can probably do without.
Yeah.
Jeff, I wanted to just, as we kind of conclude our conversation around Walt, I guess what I'm really trying to understand is there's lots of lessons in history, and there's that wonderful quote, I think it's Mark Twain, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. Over the last 100 years, the Disney Corporation has gone through lots of growth, lots of challenges, lots of setbacks, lots of lessons. We know that Walt was a multifaceted human being. We know that he was humble, he was confident, he had a vision. We know that he had setbacks. We know he had a difficult childhood. We know he could be an SOB at times. So if you were to think about the average small business owner, or even medium-sized business owner who is going through their day-to-day business and they want to channel a bit of Walt Disney thinking into their own approach, what would be three or four things that would just be pertinent to keep top of mind as they go about their day-to-day business?
This is what I write about. It's what I teach about. It's what I speak about. So I appreciate you asking that question. I think, first of all, have a vision for who you are, for who you want your business to be, and how you want to serve. You know, Walt wanted to tell stories, and he wanted to build a studio that did that. He wanted to build a park that did that. Secondly, you know, Disneyland started when he took his daughters to a merry-go-round here in downtown Los Angeles, and they're enjoying the merry-go-round, and he's sitting on a bench, and he has this idea of, gee, why isn't there a place where the parents and the children can have fun together? And I think every day we all have ideas, maybe not that will change the world, but could at least change our world, or maybe our business, or the lives of the people that we serve. The key is taking those ideas seriously, getting up off of our park bench and what?
Take action.
Thank goodness Walt got up off of his park bench. And despite all of the obstacles and all of the doubters and all of the naysayers, kept taking action. You know, I'm always challenging people, take some time to find your park bench, think, and then get up off of it and take action and keep moving forward. And then I think third, be courageous in hiring the right people. You got to find your Roys. right? Mm. And you've got to believe in your vision for what you want to accomplish, why you want to accomplish it, and how you want to accomplish it. And you know, Walt was pretty relentless. Yeah, I mean, he just knew that the details mattered and that quality would win out.
It's a really, really fascinating story. I could probably talk to you for 3 or 4 or 5 days straight on this, Jeff. And I know that you've got two wonderful books out. One's The Wisdom of Walt, and then there's Beyond the Wisdom of Walt. Right. So, ladies and gents, I'd really just encourage you to get a hold of these books, read them from cover to cover, because I think there's some lessons in there that will hold you in good stead, whether it's in business or life. Just being able to challenge yourself to think bigger, dream bigger, and step into that dream and take action every single day to bring it to fruition. Because one of the things that I really admire about what you've been saying today, Jeff, is the ability to believe in your dream even when other people don't, and the ability to not give up on that dream. Because I think there's so many people that go to the grave with unfulfilled dreams and just giving up on themselves, and that bit of doggedness that Walt has, I think, is a really good quality in life, and just to kind of have a bit of grit. In Australia, we have an expression, and I don't know if it translates very well to the United States, but I'll share it with you nonetheless, and that is to have a little bit of mongrel about you. And that is a dog that's kind of, it's not a pedigree dog, it's not a fancy dog, but it's got a bit of toughness about it, and I think there's some merit in that. So, Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us again today, mate. I really appreciate it. It's been a thrill and a pleasure to talk to you. And I hope I should mention to you, our boardroom clients, we are all heading across to Disney University in August.
Wow.
Which would be great. And we're all going there to study Disney University, to learn the leadership lessons of Walt. And we've got a whole road trip planned around that. It's going to be exciting. So hopefully maybe we can catch up for a cup of coffee while I'm there.
I'll say, when you get out to California, look me up.
That'd be amazing. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.